the title. Titles don't say everything, but, you know, they say some things. The book is not about evolution and creationism. It's about creation and God's relationship to the creation. But I do talk about natural science in one chapter. So these two talks, today and tomorrow, are spin-outs of my new book. This, by the way, I teach here. I'm professor of theology here at Pepperdine University. This is my 27th year, so I've been around a while. And this book just came out in October. And I'll tell you a little bit about it. I have a copy here. Tell you a little bit about it. The first half of the book is on creation. The second half is on providence. I give a biblical theology of creation. Then I talk about some of the huge issues in creation as well as natural science. I've always had an interest in natural science. And look at creation and time and creation and freedom and lots of other topics. In the providence book part, I look at basically a theology of providence and look especially at certain areas where there are issues in the idea of providence, with providence and human freedom, providence and evil. Okay, I just mentioned the fact that I've got several more books. Here's my book on the doctrine of God. I've got actually a couple of those that I could sell at my cost. It's not complicated, but it's academic. And here's another book I wrote recently. It's an apologetics book on Is Christianity True? Responsible Faith in a Post-Christian Culture. This is my own publication, and I sell it for $5, so you can get out of here if you're interested in apologetics. I want to talk about creation today. I want to do just a brief summary of the biblical theology of creation. Tom Albright read my book on God. I don't know if you know Tom, but he criticized it because it didn't have a biblical theology of the divine reality. And so I promised him that when I wrote a book on creation, I would put a biblical theology in there, a couple of chapters. So I did, and he read it recently. He's not doing very well, but he read the book, and he liked it. So I'm very pleased, since Tom is a mentor of mine. But in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that's sort of the theme verse of the first half of the book. And I look at time in the beginning, God, who's the creator, and the action of creation, and then what he created. So the first sentence of the Bible is a very revolutionary sentence. It has the whole doctrine of creation in it, in a sense. It has the time and the subject and the verb and the object of creation. What I do is give, I don't know if everybody can see, but I don't have a lot of space to walk around. But creation says God is the origin of everything that's not God. God is the origin, the absolute origin, and the sovereign ruler over everything that's not God. That's very, very important. Okay, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that's not God, that God is not the creator of, that God is not the Lord of. Got to keep that clearly in mind. God's creative relationship to the world is characterized in certain kind of relations of generosity and freedom and power. On the creature side, there should be gratitude, and there's dependence, and there is debt on the creature side. Okay, one thing I want to do, what I do in the book, one thing I want to do in here is look at the different kind of relationship that God has with creation than creatures have with each other. So it's important to keep God's relation to creation separate or different from the creature's kind of relation to each other and to God. Creation is good. What does it mean that everything God saw, everything was good, and it was very good? Well, it doesn't mean everything is absolutely perfect. It's going to live forever. It's as best it could possibly be. It means it's good for the purpose God created it. There's nothing in creation that can't be misused. Right? Hammers are good for nailing things. They're not good. They're not supposed to be used for hitting people. Right? So there's nothing in creation that can't be misused. including the human being, including the human body, including our time and energy. So not everything is good in the sense that it's you can use it for anything, but it can be used. It's a good thing that can be used for the purpose God intended it. All right? God was, is, and will be the creator. God being the creator is not something God was. It's something God is, and God will be. So this way of relating to the world is a relation that is sustained. It's always, God is always relating to creation as the creator. And human beings were created in the image of God and the likeness of God, and they have a special role in the creation. But what I want to do is focus on three neglected ideas. One thing that motivated me to write this book is reading over and over books on creation, books on providence, that get things mixed up. And if you get these three ideas straight, it's going to straighten out a lot of thought about providence and about creation, including the relationship of creation of theology and science. The number one, this is terminology that's probably not that familiar to you, but one, we need to get clear the difference between the creator-creation relationship and the creature-creature relationship. There's God's relationship to the whole creation, and then there's relationships of creatures to each other. Those are very, very different. If we don't get the difference, we're going to mess up the doctrine of creation and the doctrine of providence. Okay, let's think about it. The creator relates to creatures in total sovereignty. We don't relate to each other in total sovereignty. But the creator relates to all creatures in total sovereignty. To create or not to create is God's free choice. Creation is not something God has to do. It's not something that automatically happens simply because God is God. There is the freedom of God in creation. God creates creatures from nothing. This is perhaps the most fundamental idea in the doctrine of creation. We don't create anything from nothing. Creatures affect other creatures in certain ways. They pass on certain characteristics. If you hit something with a hammer, it smashes it, and it transfers energy. But God creates the world from nothing. So there are no physical laws that bind God, what God can do in creation. There are no limits on what God can create. There's no kind of creature that is logically possible to exist that God couldn't create. So you got to get it. Creation from nothing means there's nothing there. So there's no rules. There's no limits. God can do whatever God wants to do in terms of creation. Therefore, we cannot comprehend how God creates. It's very important. Because, I can't create anything from nothing. And how can I explain how God could create something from nothing? Because it's not. There's no how. There's no middle ground between something and nothing. It's either something or it's nothing. There's no transition. There's no middle ground. So it's not possible for us to explain how God creates. If I could explain how God created, that would mean there would be some transition that I could understand, and perhaps I could duplicate it. But we can't duplicate it because God creates the world from nothing. Now, that's how we should conceive God's creation, as the sovereignty over the creature, so that God creates things from nothing with no restrictions, no limits. Creatures don't experience that. Creatures affect other creatures, whether it's an atom or a molecule or another human being, within an already existing universe. It exists already. It's got to already be there. There's already got to be this system of physical laws. There's got to be cause and effect, time and space. It's within this framework that creatures affect other creatures. Are you with me? Sorry, I'm too heady here. Well, I hope not. No creature can cause the totality of another creature to exist. That's a God thing. Only God can create something from nothing, which would be the totality of the thing. We can comprehend how creatures affect other creatures. That's what we do in common sense and natural science. We can figure out the laws by which other creatures affect other creatures and transfer their characteristics and their energy. So, because natural law governs these causal relations. Right? Now, if that's true, then our study of the creature's relationship to creatures, which part of it, anyway, would be natural science, is limited to the empirical study of the empirical aspects of the creature-creature relations. Now, creatures have more than empirical relationships. We have moral relationships. We have logical relationships. We have all sorts of relationships. But natural science studies the empirical relationships of one state of affairs to a subsequent or a preceding state of affairs. It's empirical. Empirical is something you can, in some way, becomes knowable, observable through the five senses. Okay? Natural science can study that. It can't study other kinds of things. Okay? So natural science explains the transition from one empirical state of affairs to another by means of theories that apply natural laws. That's what natural science does. It can do it well, and that's all it can do. Natural science has absolutely nothing to say about the creator-creature relation, because God creates from nothing, and God is not bound by natural law, and God doesn't. God's action doesn't have to appear as a relationship of two empirical. As a empirically verifiable kind of thing. So natural science, if it is this, if it studies the empirical aspects of creatures, then has nothing to say about this other kind of relation. Right? So the doctrine of creation has absolutely nothing to say about the empirical aspects of the creature-creature relation. Now, why is that true? That's true because God can create any creature he wants. And so there's not a particular kind of creature that says, oh, that means that's a creature that God created. No, all creatures are creatures that God created, and they could be any kind of creatures and have any kind of natural laws. So the doctrine of creation, you can't predict from saying God is the creator to the kind of world that God has to create. It's not possible. The doctrine of creation from nothing is compatible with any set of natural laws and empirical state of affairs. Okay, God created the world from nothing. God could have created a different set of physical laws, a different kind of world. So we can't look at this world and make any conclusion about it with reference to God's relationship to the world, because it could have been different. So you can't say, oh, because of the first 5 minutes of the Big Bang, or because of this or that or the other, it says something theological. If believers object to what the scientist says, we can do that on two legitimate grounds. Okay, only two. Scientists are wrong on scientific grounds. If you can argue with a scientist on scientific grounds, then just, you know, be a good scientist and argue on scientific grounds. And we should be doing that. You should be doing that. Scientists debate all the time. Or you could say the scientist extends science outside its competence, which is a very common thing. My father-in-law was a doctor. Doctors sometimes think, because they're experts in surgery, they're experts in everything. And scientists often think that because they know physics or chemistry, they know metaphysics, and they know theology, and they know biblical studies, and they know lots and lots of stuff. Okay, but that's not true. And it's very tempting to extend your thought outside your competence. All right. That's the first point. And it all It all depends on getting clear the distinction between the creator-creature relation, the kind of relationship that is, which is letting things be from nothing, and the creature-creature relationship, which transfers energy and form from one state of affairs to another, a very different kind of relation. The one you cannot understand scientifically or physically or metaphysically. The other you can understand from a scientific point of view. Two, another neglected idea in reflection on creation is that creation, or God's act of creation, possesses a Christ character. We often get hung up on, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth in the Genesis, and we forget that Jesus Christ is the mediator of creation. There are four texts in the New Testament which just say this. And they're wonderful texts, John 1 through 5, and then verse 10. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. He's talking about the Word. In the beginning was the Word. And then 1 Corinthians 8:6. But there is one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom all things came, and through whom we live. It's not an anonymous creator way back in at the beginning. Jesus Christ is the one for whom the Creator created. And it has a Christ character. Colossians 1:16, for in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. Creation is not the neutral playground for history. Creation has a Christ character. It's created in him and for him. That is, it has its being in him, and it has its purpose for him. It looks forward to him as well. Hebrews 1, 2, and 10. The Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the universe and sustains all things by his powerful word. Creation has a Christ character. So, the New Testament teaching, both salvation and creation comes through Christ. And this gives creation a salvation character and salvation a creation character. You can't just say these are two totally different things. One is the beginning, the other is the completion. So, creation and salvation are two aspects of the one creator-creature relation. Two aspects. God's relation to the world has a character of letting it be and creating it. It also has the character of redeeming it and saving it. And then finally, of course, completing it and perfecting it. But it's all one relation. We get in trouble in talking about providence, especially, by saying, well, there's God created the world, and he created the world from nothing. But now, he relates to the world in a very different way, because the world exists. And that puts limits on God. And that is an incorrect view. If Christ is the creator, creation is the beginning of salvation, and salvation is the completion of creation. What creation began, salvation completes. All right? You're with me? We're doing pretty good on time. We're going to have time for questions or vegetables. The act of creation, now this is a little tricky. You got to think about this one with me. But it's very important because it's one of those three neglected ideas that distort our views in providence and creation. The act of creation applies to all time. As I said, God was, is, and will be the creator. Because God is eternal and time is an aspect of creation, several things follow from that. There was no time before creation. Time was created with creation. There was not an ever-expanding amount of time, and then at one moment God created the world, because time is a part of our world. It's the way creatures like us have to live, and all the other creatures have to live. God has always been the creator. Some people say, well, God can change because God wasn't the creator and now became the creator. But that puts God in time rather than being eternal. So there was no time before creation. Time was created with creation. God has always been the creator, and creation has always been, though it is not eternal. I mean, whenever there was time, there was a creation. That's what I mean by always been. Creation is not eternal. Augustine, it's not my idea, this is Augustine and Thomas Aquinas I'm going to quote to you, and it's been all the great Christian thinkers up until the modern era. For he has always existed in unchangeable eternity, while they were created. Again, notice how the great theologian Augustine distinguishes between God's mode of being and creation's mode of being. God's mode of creating things and creature's mode of creating things. God is eternal, we're temporal, and are said to have been always because they have been in all time. Time being impossible without the creature. But time, passing away by its changefulness, cannot be co-eternal with changeless eternity. Okay? So, Augustine says, creation has always been, meaning anytime there was time, there was creation. Because time is a creature. It's not God. Time is a creature. Time is a mode of being, of imperfect beings who have to realize their being sequentially and actualize their potential. I'm terrible at illustrations. I'm terrible. But this is the best I could do. Eternity. It should be sort of like a point. But eternity embraces the time of creation in one simultaneous instant, if you want to call it. There's a difference between eternity and everlasting time. We get them confused. We think there's a timeline and it goes back infinitely. And God always has been and God always will be in this infinite timeline. But that's not the concept of eternity. That's called everlastingness or everlasting time. And there's a difference because even if there's everlasting time, that means things have always been changing and growing and dying and developing. But that's imperfection and God is perfect. Now, Boethius is a thinker in the 6th century who coined the classic definition of eternity, which is picked up by, was already in earlier philosophy, but it's picked up in the Middle Ages and right on down to Karl Barth in the 20th century preferred this definition of eternity. The common opinion, according to all men living, that's pretty exaggerated perhaps, but it certainly would be today, but it sounds good, doesn't it? Is that God is eternal. Let us therefore consider what is eternity. Eternity is the simultaneous and complete possession of infinite life. Simultaneity. That is, that God is not waiting to become God. He's not thinking back about what he was when he was a kid. No, God is completely whole all at once. Time for us is life and being. God's life and being is always present to him, not some memory or some anticipated future. This will appear more clearly if we compare it with temporal things. All that lives under the conditions of time moves through the present from the past to the future. There is nothing set in time which can at one moment grasp the whole space of its lifetime. I can't do that. I don't know about you. I mean, am I that kid that was 10 years old? Yeah, I remember him, sort of. But I'm not me all at once. I'm me as I am spread out. When will I ever be me? Only in God's eternity will I become fully what I am. There is nothing set in time. Okay. It cannot yet comprehend tomorrow. Yesterday is already lost. And in this life of today, your life is no more than a changing, passing moment. what we should rightly call eternity is that which grasps and possesses wholly and simultaneously the fullness of unending life, which asks not of the future, which is lost not of the fleeting past. And such an existence must ever be present to itself to control and aid itself, and also must keep present with itself the infinity of changing time. Therefore, people who hear that Plato thought that this universe had no beginning of time and will have no end are not right thinking that in this way the world was created co-eternal with its creator. I should have left that last sentence off. That just confuses us. Eternity is simultaneous and complete presence of God's eternal life. That's not our mode of life. Thomas Aquinas said something very similar to Augustine, but he makes a little bit of a difference. Nothing, therefore, prevents our saying that God's action existed from all eternity, whereas its effect was not present from eternity, but existed at the time when, from all eternity, he ordained it. For the before that we speak of as preceding time implies nothing temporal in reality, but only in our imagination. Indeed, when we say that time exists after not existing, we mean that there was no time at all prior to this designated now. That's complicated up front. But what he's saying is we have to imagine creation occurring in a timeline. But just because we have to imagine it doesn't mean that we have to think of it as being real. It's imaginary time. That's just how we think. We can't get around it. But there was no time before, because there was no before of creation. Okay? Because God is eternal, and God created time at once. Okay. Now, hence, God's creation is not merely a past event. I was thinking about this today because I've had conversations with good friends who are creationists, good friends who are evolutionists. And for me, when I say God's creation, I'm going to talk more about this in Providence, but creation applies to today, to you and I, as much as it did to any past event, even the first event. So yes, God did create the world all at once. But that's not past event. That's the whole thing. It includes the past, the present, and the future. So from one perspective, instantaneous creation is perfectly correct from the eternal point of view. It's instantaneous, all at once, including what we're doing today, and our lives, and in the future, and the past. But on the other hand, within the creation is linked up and hooked, and the cause and effect and time is operative within creation. So, and it can be studied from within, or you can think of it as instantaneous from without. One is the creator's relationship to the creation, and the other is the creature's relationship to the creation. So I think the problem is solved, right? It is for me, but you know, it may not be for others. But, God relates to creation directly from eternity as the creator, not from within time. God is, of course, right here in our time. But if you think of it as God relating directly from eternity into our time, it much help solve so many more problems than thinking of God as in the past, sort of manipulating things, pushing things within the cause and effect within the world. God causes the whole world, including all the relationships that are within the world. And I think I have, amazingly, 15 minutes for questions. So, I want to talk to you, yes.
In point one, you mentioned that God is not bound by laws of nature. But does God maintain the laws of nature? In other words, how do we know that laws of nature are dependable? Is it because God makes them dependable?
Well, okay, by laws of nature, we mean the system God has set up. Okay? Laws of nature are not logical laws. They're not metaphysical laws. So, for all we know, from physics or from thinking metaphysically or theologically, that could be different. So, God's creation is reliable because God is reliable. Natural law, of course, has its validity, and we should assume that natural law has its validity within creation. But it doesn't mean that God could not have created a different set of natural laws. But he created this one. I guess he wanted them, right? And we need the world to be reliable, and the world is what God has created. So, but it's within the creation. We shouldn't bind those natural laws on God. I think maybe logic is a little bit different in the sense that we have no possibility of imagining a world where contradictories can be both true. That's not even imaginable. But we can imagine creatures that don't exist. And we can imagine whole sets of laws that are not here. So that's imaginable, it's thinkable, it's possible. So it's not good to think of God as super beyond logic. Logic is not beyond God either. So natural law is not logic. I don't know who's next, but let's go.
The analogy that's always helped me is this idea of God holding a jar of marbles, in which in each marble is every single event in history within time.
Okay.
And he's holding that, and he can look at any moment in time from the outside, or even a string of marbles on a strand. They're all mm-hmm. occurring. Mm-hmm. And again, that kind of goes against, or that kind of implies that God is looking at all this stuff happening. But it's kind of all happening, you know, at the same time, if that makes sense. How accurate would that analogy
well,
be?
Well, I see only one thing wrong with it. Thomas Aquinas used a similar analogy. He said, although you don't want to get Thomas's understanding of providence completely from foreknowledge, okay? But if you're on a mountain and you see a caravan going, you can look down and you can see the caravan, you can see the beginning and the end, whereas the people at the beginning can't see the end. But if you're up on the mountain, you can see the perspective. And that's sort of like divine foreknowledge. But it can be used to put God outside the causal. See, when I see the caravan, I'm not causing the caravan to exist. So God doesn't need to see what's happening in order to know what's happening. That's what creatures have to do. But God is the cause of the world. So God knows what's going on in the world because he is the cause of the world. So I talk about this in the book. But just sheer foreknowledge is not good enough. Because then something has to exist before it can generate knowledge in me. But that's not true of God, because God is the sole absolute origin of the world and everything in it. So he doesn't have to see it happening before he knows it's happening, because he's a part of it happening. I'm not a fatalist, but nevertheless, God is involved in all events. Otherwise, they wouldn't be happening. They couldn't be. Yes.
So you say that God eternally is related to creation as a creator. Like, he is. So, I mean, how does that make creation not necessary?
Well, Thomas Aquinas dealt with that. If you want to read about it, he's your favorite. And he's mine, too. But the world depends on God. And therefore, it can't be necessary for God. And even if it... again, that's why Thomas wanted to use the imaginary time, because it helps us see the difference between something always existing and something being necessary. Because then we can say, oh yes, it's not necessary, because God's eternity is a different mode of being than time. So you can think of imaginary time as a way to imagine God's eternity. And then you can see the difference between a necessary creation or an eternal creation and a creation that includes all time, but is still totally, absolutely dependent on God, and God's freedom is preserved. Yes.
You were talking about how salvation is the completeness of creation.
Yes.
Can you unpack that a little bit more?
Well, why did God create the world? Again, did God create the world for, let's see what happens. No, God had purposes in creating the world. I mean, read Ephesians chapter 1. Again, I have a little section in there on why God created the world. Well, somehow or another, Jesus Christ was involved in the reason God created the world. Right? Not only as the means through which God created the world, but as Colossians says, in him and for him. Creation looks forward to what God is going to do with the whole thing and get it complete in Christ. And I think that's terribly exciting. Christ is not an accidental thing that happened in history sort of to kind of take care of what Adam and Eve messed up. No, from the beginning, Christ is the goal of creation. That's, I think, what the New Testament is talking about. Jesus Christ is the eschatological Savior. He's the one that brings the whole world together. He couldn't be that unless he was back there at the beginning and unless he was the goal to start with. Unless you want to think that God does stuff kind of on the fly. And
so,
I do not.
So creation continues even though the goal is reached? And
how
do you deal with that?
All creatures, we're not going to become God in the sense of like undo our creatureliness. I think that our hope is to be united with God so that we participate. Eternal life is not something we have. It's something we can be graced with. And we can share in God's eternal life in the resurrection. But we will not ever cease to be creatures dependent on the love and grace of God. I think you can.
When you think of God being outside of time, there seems something that's unattractive about that, in that we like to believe that God is with us in time, experiencing our crisis.
Yeah.
Here's my moment of crisis,
and
that God is...
Yeah.
So
God is not outside of time.
Okay, so
but time does not is not a mode of God's being, such that, in other words, again, think of omnipresence. God is not the same thing as the world, but he's fully present to the world in its most intimate act, which is its act of being. God gives being to everything that is. So God is closer to me than I am myself. I don't know myself, but God knows me. So God is intimately close. So, but the Creator is not, a part of nature that's giving me being. The Creator transcends my being and he gives me being. So, in the same way, God's eternity encompasses all time. It's not, again, we don't want to think of eternity as time, but God... Because God is eternal, and precisely because God is eternal, he can be present to every moment of time simultaneously. Because if God is temporal, he can't be present in the past. He can't be present in the future. He can only be present now. And then, I suppose, we would have to either determine fatalistically what happens in the future, or kind of work with whatever happens. So I don't think that's a problem, if eternity is properly understood. Because I didn't say God is outside time or God is timeless. And in fact, in my book on God, I take to task the idea that God is timeless. God has time, but it's an eternal mode of time simultaneity. And the doctrine of the Trinity is a very important part of that. Did you?
Boltzmann talks about space.
Yeah.
And he talks about in the beginning, before time, before the creation, there was nothing but God, right? And then he explains that...
You've already got me skeptical.
But he says, but I like, he asks the question, he makes the point, God had to withdraw himself in order to have space for the creation because nothing existed.
I've written several things refuting that. I just think that's awful, but... Okay. Well, here's a Moltmann's modern theologian who's very creative, very brilliant, very creative. But he wrote a book on God and creation. What's the name of that book? Creation. And he uses a medieval Jewish myth, and it's called the Tzimtzum. And it basically says God was omnipresent, but in order for, if God is omnipresent, there's no room for creatures. Or, you know, there's no room. So God has to shrink himself and make room. Now, that's a metaphor. Mm-hmm. That's a metaphor. But what it really means is somehow or another God has to cease to be active in a certain sphere so that we can have our action. But what he does is he's one of the ones I'm talking about when I say if you don't get this God-world relation straight and the distinction between the God-world relation, because God doesn't displace anything when he's omnipresent. I mean, it's not like God weighs a certain amount or has a certain amount of energy or something. I mean, I can't be in, no physical thing can displace another physical thing without destroying it. In fact, it can't do that. But God can be absolutely, totally present without displacing anything. And that is also true of our freedom and our thoughts and everything in creation. God can be fully present and active in that without denaturing it, destroying it, replacing it. And that's why Moltmann is, I think, so wrong, because he wants to see all theology's interpretation of the cross. And in the cross, he thinks, God ceased to be God. The Trinity was split apart, and God died. And God died to make room for sinners. I mean, there's a certain element of truth to that, but, you know, I keep talking about my book, but I've thought about all this stuff. And I talk about that in the last chapter, yes.
Wouldn't it be more appropriate to say that God withdraws his glory from certain situations, certain places? In order for, maybe that's just anthropomorphic, I don't know, but it, you know, you see that expression that his glory is gone, is departed.
No, I'm with you there. The medievals talked about God being omnipresent in, let's see, essence, power, and something else. Three modes. But it's true that God is not overwhelmingly, obviously present to all creatures, which we hope one day he will be. But that doesn't mean he's not present in the mode that he wills to be to help creatures exist and be. So, yeah, he did hide his glory, or in Jesus Christ. He humbled himself and became a servant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you talk about the relationship between physical object and spiritual reality?
Well, by spiritual reality, I mean God. That's the only... there are created other modes of existence, but, you know, when you really talk about spiritual reality, we're talking about God. And as I said, God is not a being among other beings like a molecule or an acid or a physical object. God is the cause of being of all things. Therefore, God doesn't displace those things. So there's no competition there. Thomas Aquinas talked about prime causality and secondary causality, causality. God is the cause of all things. Things within the creation cause each other. Both causes are valid. But God, being the cause of everything, enables other things to be the cause of other things. Because if God wasn't the cause of the world, that is what creation is, then we wouldn't exist, and no creature would exist to have any cause of power on other. Now, there is a theory called occasionalism, which evacuates the world of secondary causality. But no, that's not. The world really exists. It really has causal powers. So when the water boils, it's the fire that causes it. But God causes all things. One more thing, and you go.
Just with all that you've talked about thus far, how would you incorporate the idea of the incarnation within that, and this idea of the cruciform, the theme of the lectures and everything? How would you include that within all of it you said?
I do.
I
do. I don't have a simple answer to that. Other than God is absolutely present to all creatures. There's no contradiction between the divine nature and any creaturely nature. So God can enter into our sphere in the most intimate way without displacing it or destroying it. So to say that Jesus Christ was both God and man is not a contradiction.
And then as it relates to the exaltation of Christ, post-resurrection as well.
Well, the exaltation of Christ, you know, he is exalted, he takes the world with him because he's human, and he takes the human being, and because he is a human and a creature within the creation, he exalts the whole thing. God comes down to us to lift us up to God. And I know I have more thoughts than that, sure. But...
It's a teaser anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's just continue, you and I, maybe later. But okay. I want to conclude on time because I'm just that sort of person. So thank you for being here, and I will talk about problems.
Thank you. You're temporal, that's what you are.
Suppose that God is good and creature is good. Sorry for that great question. But what about then the evil? How do we explain the being of evil?
It's I have the whole part, the third part of the book is about
evil. I'm with that.
Yes. God.
I would agree very that neither
of
you
hope is that obviously all evil and imperfection will be overcome and creation will be perfected. But now there are imperfections, there are bad things that happen, there is sin. So clearly God allows that to happen, but that doesn't mean that he's the cause of it. Because evil is not something that is, well, the classic solution to that problem is that evil is not a substance. It's not a creature. It's not a thing. Evil is an absence, a privation, a defect. Yeah. Thanks for coming. A defect, a privation. I mean, death is not a thing. It's the cessation of life, the integrity of life. So death is not a thing. But God allows creatures and gives them their time. God is not under obligation to let creatures live forever or give them absolute perfection forever. So God allows creatures to live and die. And we, of course, don't like to have them. I want to suffer.
But he isn't just allowed. He actually sent us to do.
Yeah. It's connected to the possibility of redemption, because the sin death is not unrelated to the hope of redeeming us and redeeming us.
You like the teaching part of the profession better or the writing?
Actually, I love the teaching. I love teaching. And I think of my books as teaching, really. I mean, I'm thinking it out for myself because I love thinking and kind of philosophical and I want to write it down.
You said you've been here 27 years.
Yeah.
Where were you before this?
Well, actually, I was in the ministry. I was a campus minister, youth minister, and
from the youth ministry. So I can jump in here.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of kids that are unchurched, and we even have a couple of my friends. I do research at the laboratory, so science lab.
Yeah.
And I would classify them as a questioning atheist.
Uh-huh.
And obviously, you know, the very first thing is, you know, building your relationship and, you know, showing the love of Christ. But he asked me this question. He says, you know, who created God? And it opens up some conversations, you know, but I don't feel like I adequately answered that. How would you go about answering that?
Yeah, well.
You run into that question.
Oh, yeah. Something has to be eternal. That's right.
Oh, okay, that's where you are.
That's
okay.
Rational.
Is she going to be there?
So we're not talking about whether or not something is eternal, because that's what that question sort of gets at. How could God be eternal?
Okay.
So really, it's a false premise. It could assume that there could have been a time when there's absolutely nothing that Okay. Nobody believes that. Atheists don't believe that. They believe matter is eternal. So we can dispense with that idea and just and get to the real question. What is the nature of the eternal thing? That's the issue. What's the nature of the eternal thing? What kind of thing does it make sense to think that could be eternal, but which could be the origin and source of all of the things? Atheists will try to say matter. In this red book, I'd actually go through that argument.
Mm. Yeah, because see, for someone like us, we're believers, it's easy for us to make that jump, but for somebody that you know has serious doubts, how do you help them?
That's right. So we have to think like them. We have to go back and ask that question that they're not asking. Because, you know, as you know, most atheist questions to believers are designed because they work. They're trick questions. They're not really necessarily deep, thoughtful questions because, as I said in that one, it doesn't really actually admit that they believe something is eternal too.
Right.
Because you could say, who created matter?
Right.
Where did matter come from?
Right.
And then they would have to say, well, it's just eternal. Oh, okay. So we're in a stalemate. Right. So the question is, what's the nature of the eternal thing, which is the origin and foundation of all of the things? And I argue in that book, look, it's got to be a mind. It's got to be mental.
So what I didn't get out of what you said today, the answer to the question that was the topic, which is what neither evolutionists nor creationists.
In my experience, and I didn't mean to imply that no creationist, no evolutionist ever thinks this. Mm-hmm. What I mean is this distinction between the creator, the way the creator relates to creation by creating from nothing. To me, the creation from nothing applies to all space, all time, always.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way God relates. That whatever that means, we can't grasp what that means. But
it's foundational.
It is foundational. Mm-hmm. And in my view, evolutionists want to trace everything back in a causal chain through physical causes. Well, obviously, you're not going to get to anything. That way.
Well, they have to make everything
naturalistic.
Well, naturalistic and material, material.
Yeah.
And therefore, they have to make matter eternal.
Yeah.
They have to make matter having no beginning, which it isn't.
Right.
I mean, when we look at it, we can see that it's not.
And in my view, some creationists argue, and I'm thinking here not of scientific creationism, but of design theory,
intelligent design.
Sometimes they think of God as a cause, or at least they're implying that God is perceptible by empirical methods.
Uh-huh.
God's action is empirically perceptible, and I think that's a mistake. But I think God's reality is perceptible through a more of a hermeneutical or a philosophical rather than an empirical. Because when I look out at the world, I see the presence of a divine mind. But I perceive that not by empirical study, but by perceiving order and...
Okay, well, that's because you don't really start out there. But for a guy who's a scientist who's digging down deep into it, he gets to see it at a level you don't ever get to see it.
That's
probably why he looks at it that way.
Yeah, but I think... Yeah, but that can also... That can be a benefit. That can also be a liability because... you don't have to be a physicist in order to see.
You don't have to be
order.
No.
And especially in this book, what I'd say is the best place to start is your own mind.
Or your garden.
Or your garden. But if we're looking outside, we're always looking at something that we don't have direct experience of. And the thing we have direct experience of is our minds.
Yeah, we're the most complex of all. Yeah.
And we're the only ones that we know from the inside. Everything else we look at from outside, unless we get it inside by seeing an order there, and then we perceive order.
So, are you aware of the biologos influence here, and you've examined all that? You feel comfortable with that?
No, I'm not. I know the word.
Uh-huh.
I have other interests.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
What is that?
Well, it's actually an organization.